Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. on Wednesday in time for So What's Your Story? We are the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Greg Audell, and alongside a team saturated in talent, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, media maven and engineer Nicole Rocherlin, and gifted intern Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the story of by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely to the present. I'm also, as always, joined by Floyd the Wonder Dog, who is sound asleep in my lap, but you might be hearing him throughout the show. All of us remember the lost and found from our days in school. Don't you? That big box, you know, with one glove, one raincoat, one boot in it. We loved the jubilation when we found whatever we lost. And if we never found it, we found a way to fill the void. That's possible with things like yo-yos, textbooks, wallets and backpacks. But losing a loved one carries a different kind of weightiness, a feeling that the void cannot be replaced. And more important, that it shouldn't be replaced. On the other hand, as Tevye would say in Fiddler on the Roof, there's always another hand. Losses can also be temporary. Tonight, my guest tellers have different stories about loss and even the attempt at replacing it. Amanda Dayton is a storyteller with a penchant for the poignant, as demonstrated in one of the stories she will tell tonight, one she told at the Moth's Grand Slam this past May. Other than being a fantastic storyteller, Amanda is a designer for Ethan Allen. I need your help. Dr. Michael Winters has been on our program a few times and has told some of the most riveting stories about family that our listeners have ever heard. Family therapist, board member on the Houston Storytellers Guild, our proud sponsor, and part of the clan of excellent tellers. Michael's here with a tale that will make us all go, whew. Amanda, Michael, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Oh, great to be here. Good to meet you, Amanda.
Good to meet you as well.
And Floyd is very pleased to meet you both. Michael, you've been on the radio before, so what kind of advice can you give Amanda that she can absorb for the next 55 minutes and some odd seconds?
I think just relax and don't let Greg intimidate you.
All right, got it.
Oh, man. That was my plan all along. Now, I'm not really worried about you at all, Amanda. I have seen you in action on stage and know you're a powerhouse. You know, you told me that you've always been something of a storyteller and come from a long line of storytellers, but when did you start telling stories publicly?
I told my first story publicly at a Moth Story Slam about 6 months after my mom passed away. It was part of a healing process. She always wanted me to perform, and I thought getting up there and telling a story for her was something I could do to honor her, and it was a good healing process.
Wow, no pressure there. I don't know if I could have kept myself together for that.
It was a tough one, but I got through it.
I'm sure. The story you're about to tell is about your mother, and it made a huge impression on me and the entire audience the first time we were fortunate enough to listen to it at the Moth Grand Slam last May. Would you tell us that story?
Oh, absolutely. It starts, I think we should get married and have two little girls, said my dad to my mom after only having casually dated her a short while. And he was on the heels of a failed marriage to a Carolina beauty queen who had left a wife-sized hole in his heart he was trying desperately to fill. She was the single mom of two boys and had been thoroughly burned by love. So had she known that he had proposed to a few other ladies that summer, things may have shook out different, but fate had plans for these two. And anyone who knew my parents would tell you they shared a wild and enviable love. The kind of love that would light up any room they were in. But it was volatile, as wild things can be, and their relationship was a pendulum constantly swinging between frenzied passion and absolute chaos. And they loved to tell me growing up how difficult it was to get me here, After 5 years of trying, it took my mom, as my dad would tell it, my mom locking him in a cabin for 5 days, and as he would put it, she came out pregnant and he came out prematurely bald. And life with them was an adventure. They just were not your average parents. My parents, they were magic makers. They were moon howlers. They weren't doling out bedtimes or chatting over the news in the evenings. No, they were the kind of parents that had more fun on Halloween than you did. And for what it's worth, whatever their parenting style was, it was highly effective on me in that it produced an overachieving, obsessive young person with an insatiable need to please. And it also made me deeply grateful for my brothers, especially having one still at home who could revel in the weirdness with me and also, you know, comfort me if their pendulum swung too far sideways. And I guess it's when I realized, being 10 years older than me, inevitably he would be jumping ship, I began to campaign for a new baby. And mission baby was twofold. If I couldn't coax my brother into staying forever, I knew I was going to need reinforcements. And two, I couldn't think of anything else to settle these cusses down. So I was relentless for years. Every letter to Santa, every birthday candle wish, if I fell ill and in my parents' doting they said, "Amanda, is there anything we can get for you?" I wouldn't miss the opportunity to say, "I think you know." But years went by and no baby, and just when I became, you know, discouraged enough to campaign for things like cable, my mom announced at 42 that she was pregnant, and I had never been so happy. I had made a baby. And it was really difficult for me to give my mom space during that pregnancy. She told me as much. And when it was time to go to the hospital, there was no leaving me behind. I stayed with my mom for 3 full days of labor, and I stood next to my dad, and I watched my little sister be born. I was actually the first person the doctors gave her to. Finally, I had my ally in this world, and we named her Allie. And naturally, she was my most beloved and treasured plaything. She was a happy but serious baby. She loved animals and could be lulled to sleep by the sexy stylings of Kenny G. And she grew to be my minion, my confidant, my very closest friend. And while her presence didn't save our parents' marriage as I had hoped, it did save me from enduring that heartache alone. And as we've grown, so has our bond. We have carried each other through triumphs and tremendous heartbreak. When I was 22 and Allie only 12, our father passed away very suddenly. And never one to be outdone, our mother left this world as sudden and unexpectedly as he had 10 years before her. And losing them was so immense, it was like a vacuum sucking up all the wonder and chaos and beauty they had put in our lives. And if it was just me without her, I think it may have destroyed me. And on the days that I grieve for them and it's hard for me, I remind myself that the greatest gift they ever gave us was each other. And if there's one universal truth, it is if you put love in this world, you can never truly be gone. And we are proof of the love that they shared, a love that began with a sincere enough proposal and ended with two little girls. Thanks.
Wow, Amanda, it's hard to speak when I've got goosebumps all over my body.
Thanks, Greg.
No, it's true. It had the same effect on me when I heard it at the Grand Slam. You know, one question I thought when I heard it the first time and this time is, what would your mother say to you, knowing, you know, that you were able to tell this story, her story, your story, on stage before hundreds of people?
She would be clicking her heels saying, "Finally, finally, you were born for the stage, baby." That was my mom.
That makes it an even more moving tribute. It really does. There are lots of lessons, but what is the single most important thing you want us to take away from your story?
Oh, love your family. Tomorrow's not promised. Cherish the moments. If you've got an issue with somebody, work it out. Life's too short.
That's beautiful. If I might add my own caveat to that is I consider family to be a pretty elastic term. Family's made up of the people who you choose for it to be.
Absolutely.
Oftentimes they're related to you by blood, and oftentimes they're not.
Truly.
Wow, that's a meaningful message. Now, Michael's both a superb teller of and a family counselor. What are your impressions of Amanda's story?
Well, I think the things that really stood out to me were the uniqueness of the people and the flaws. You know, that's what makes family. Everybody is unique, and when they can own that uniqueness, and that uniqueness comes with, you know, pieces that aren't always perfect, but make up a family.
Well, I do like that because sometimes after someone passes, I don't recognize the person everybody's talking about. The sainted individual that never made a mistake, that wasn't generally the person I knew. It was someone I knew and loved for all their flaws and, you know, imperfections, you know, that made them a human being. I like the fact that you presented them more as they were than, you know, as Hallmark would want them to be. Now, Michael, you have a story that contains humor, fear, and consequence, and each were ignited by the feeling of loss. Is there any background we need to know before you tell us your story?
It's very different than Amanda's.
By design. Well, we're looking forward to it, and we would love to hear it.
Okay. In 1995, in July, I had been married just a few weeks and decided to go to the beach with my brand new 13 and 10-year-old stepdaughters. Now, Kelly, my bride, had to work that day, so it was just going to be the three of us. And we were excited. It was you know, really going to be bonding and an adventure. So we headed down to Galveston on a Thursday, and the sun was in the sky. 10 a.m., no clouds, already hot, and as we pulled into Galveston, we could smell the sea air and hear the muffled waves and hear the seagulls chatting to each other. And we pulled up onto the seawall, and there's hardly anybody else out there. And we, you know, kind of gathered our umbrella and our towels, and I, before I left the car, made sure that I locked the wallet and my spare key in the glove compartment and locked the car before we left. And we ran down to the beach, ran right into the water, and it was so lovely, cool, gentle waves. We waded out to where I was up to my waist and the girls almost up to their necks, and we could feel the motion of the waves, and I could feel the motion on my finger. Now, you know, as a newlywed, I still had a heightened sensation of the ring on my ring finger. And I also had the sensation of the water removing the ring and the ring falling off my finger. Now, I felt it, so I knew it couldn't have gotten far. So optimistically, I rallied the girls and we started a valiant search. Now, I've given you the impression that Galveston beaches have the crystal clear aquamarine waters that you see in the Bahamas ads. I was misleading. We couldn't see inches into the water, let alone several feet. But we were optimistic. We strove for quite a while until we all realized that we probably were not going to see that wedding band again. And I thought, you know, I'm only weeks into this marriage. This can't be a good omen. But we collected ourselves, kind of dejectedly walked back up to the beach and started to plan what we were going to do next. Now, did I mention that before we went into the water, I was being very careful with the car key and put it in the little security pouch in my swim trunks, you know, the kind with the flap that folds over, so that, of course, everything will stay secure. Apparently, those do not work in the Gulf of Mexico, because when we got back to the beach, we realized no key either. So, fortunately, we were on the seawall. We kind of had our little few things, went across the street to a Jamaican restaurant. you know, there were no cell phones back then and no quarter in my pocket either. And we asked them if we could call AAA, and they allowed us to do that. And I got on the phone with AAA, and the operator said, "I just need your AAA number so I can release a truck to come out." I said, "Well, you see, the problem is that's locked inside the car, which is why I need you." And one of the girls overheard this and said, "Why don't we call Mom and she'll give this number?" No, I vetoed that really quickly. I did not want Kelly knowing the predicament we were in. Eventually, AAA came. They opened the car. We moved on. And we still had the afternoon. So the girls wanted to go to a different beach where maybe there would be more surf, not realizing it was Galveston. But anyway, we said, "Great, we'll go get boogie boards." They did that. They went off in the surf, and I took our umbrella and stabbed it into the sand and sat relaxing under the shade of the umbrella until a big gust of wind came along and blew the umbrella over. I got up, put it back, got it secure, sat under it again, until another big gust of wind came and knocked it over a second time. Now, there had been tension building in this day. It had not been to plan. And at this point, I let my frustration rule me, and I took the umbrella and started smashing it into the ground several times, 3, 4, maybe 6, 7 times, I don't know. I felt much better until I looked out into the surf and saw my two stepdaughters staring back at me, kind of amazed. They had seen me lose my cool, as well as my ring and my key, but I didn't take it out on them. You know, 23 years later, my daughters still have that image of me and love to embarrass me with that image of me smashing the umbrella in the sand.
Wow, Michael, how long was it before you could laugh at this story?
Well, they could laugh at it really fast. I don't know. It's been a while, but it's been 23 years.
And I think my follow-up was, how long was it before you told Kelly?
I think the girls probably told her that evening.
They were 10 or 13?
It didn't last. But, but you know, it was cementing family in a way.
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of when my mother was studying for the bar exam. She asked my sister and I and my mother's partner just to get out of the house for a day. Mm-hmm. So we went on her partner's sailboat, and we got stuck on a sandbar in Galveston for like several hours. When we came back, my mother was like, thank you for staying gone so long. It took us a while to tell her that we weren't really all that thoughtful. Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, you are a man of parables. So can you tell us one that belongs to your story?
Well, sometimes the things you lose lead to things that are even more valuable.
Mm. Certainly was in that case, it seems like.
Yep.
Wow. Well, this is Greg Audell with Nicole Rocherlin on the boards, and you are listening to guest storytellers Amanda Dayton and Michael Winters on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 for our friends in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, Texas. One thing we'll never lose is the astonishing abilities of Nicole and Tatiana for filling us in on all the excellent storytelling venues in Houston. Is that right, ladies?
I have no idea what you're talking about. Of course, that is right. I've been waiting all night for this moment, Greg, and thank you for giving it to me.
Because of course. It's not a radio show without your laughter.
I agree. But, you know, it's because this is one of the rockin' storytelling towns around. Best place to start is with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, and they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset.
Did you hear that, friends? That is every single month. Say it again.
1500 Sunset.
Yes.
So be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. And that's every single solitary show since 2008 listed under the menu under radio program tab, which, you know, now exceeds 350. So we're super excited about that and is cited as one of the best, let me say that again, the best storytelling inventories around.
Amen.
Tatiana, I know you have more to add to that H-Town, storytelling lineup, don't you, girl?
I sure do, Nicole. Everyone should join our friends at The Moth the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is August 14th, and the theme will be collaboration, and it's truly more fun than the law allows. Also, we want our listeners to stay addicted to So What's Your Story and to know that not having a radio is not an excuse for missing our program, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. Don't forget to visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and to share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Nicole, did we cover everything?
Girl, no. Let me go and tell them about this YouTube channel. Y'all better go subscribe to our YouTube channel because it's popping. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, too.
We are everywhere, aren't we?
We are.
And I got to say, in all seriousness, it's, you know, in large part because of the efforts of you two, and we appreciate it no end. You know, every week we get more emails, more input in from our listeners, and our audience grows. And it's in large part because y'all are helping make it happen, as well as our wonderful storytellers that come on. You know, you never know if it's going to be a serious story, a folk tale, or a funny story, but we guarantee you it's going to be a great story every time you tune in to So What's Your Story? A few weeks ago at the beginning of our fun drive, Hank played a story by Alley actor David Rainey. The comments we got requests to play it again were overwhelming. So, you know, I thought this would be a nice time to play another one of David's stories. And we'll get Hank to chime in and tell us about it. You around there, Hank?
I am. Thank you, Greg. I'm enjoying the show. Amanda, terrific, terrific. Love your story.
Thank you.
I really am. And Michael, you're not too bad, too.
Thanks, Hank. Appreciate it.
You guys are terrific.
Hey, that's better praise than I've ever gotten from
you guys.
Hank.
So you guys are terrific.
Take it.
Thank you. But I appreciate this chance. You know, David's a friend of mine, and many years ago, September 28th, 2012, to be exact, he was on the show, and he was a nervous wreck, and I asked him why. And he said, because I'm an actor. I'm not really a storyteller. And, of course, I praised him, and I said, well, of course you're a storyteller. You have to tell stories to be a great actor. And he said, I know, but I'm usually wearing costumes. I'm coming up with an accent. I've got lighting. I've got costumes, color, something. I've got me, and that's it, and a microphone. And it occurred to him at that moment how very different storytelling was. In any event, that really kind of spawned a very wonderful story that he told. And the theme of that night, it was a 30-minute program, was Lingering Thoughts. It was about stories that had to be told, literally had to be told, in order to overcome some sense of paralysis, if that makes any sense. He had to tell these stories. And he told two stories. One of them was about, it was the death of a sister. It was sad but wonderful, and about her puppy. And that's the story, Greg, that you're talking about, the one that got some pretty remarkable comments.
That story stayed with me
for quite a while. It's interesting because the theme was lingering thoughts, and these are stories that clearly linger with us.
Absolutely.
The other story is the one that Nicole's about to play. This one is really more about spirituality and loss. It deals with his sister. This is why it's important to give a little background on that first story. The death of his sister and how his sister spoke to him and his family in a time when he felt she literally saved their lives. Enough said. Let's go ahead and listen to the story. Nicole?
Hangs on, man.
Yeah. No reason to, but I'm excited to hear this one.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was probably within a year of my youngest sister's passing away that my dad again got stationed to Nellis Air Force Base. So we had to make the move from Clovis, New Mexico to Las Vegas, Nevada. The Air Force provided the moving van, so that was taken care of. And now it was time to get on the road trip across New Mexico, Utah, and Nevada. It was in the evening, and you know, we were nearing Las Vegas, maybe a couple hours away. And as we approached the small town, there was a burger hut on the side of the road. It was one of those one-room places with nothing but a kitchen and a counter. It also had a long awning extending out towards the street like a giant tail of a 1957 Thunderbird. It was kind of a 60s version of the Sonic. My dad decided to stop there and get us some food, and for some reason, he didn't want to drive up into the parking lot. The place was crowded with locals. It was on a two-lane highway, so he decided to park off to the side of the road and walk up. After he left, my mom was looking over at the place, and she said, "They have picnic tables over there." The three of us kids were in the back seat doing who knows what, you know, keeping ourselves busy the way the kids tend to when they're in the back seat together. My mom, though, kept looking back and at that place and then thinking about it and then looking back and thinking about it. And then she said it again. "They have tables over there. I think we should go eat at those tables." And she didn't make a move then, but she kept looking. She seemed fixed on the idea, like it wouldn't go away. And I remember that she brought it up a couple more times before she finally said, "Come on, guys, let's go." So we all got out and walked up to the place, which got noisier the closer we got, with voices and the tinny sounds of country music from the outside speakers. Inside, the small place looked crowded, and I couldn't make out where my father was. There were four wooden picnic tables sitting just outside the door. I honestly don't remember if the others were occupied, but we were just settling in when suddenly there was a noise from the street. A long screech and a violent impact grabbed everybody's attention. All heads turned. At first, I couldn't tell what happened. I was trying to see, but I really didn't know what I was looking for. My eyes finally fell on our car, which was now in a field next to the highway. Our car had been hit from behind, and it was smashed. Its trunk, packed to its limits, was crumpled up, and much of its contents were now in the back seat. A couple of people ran out into the street to help out or get a better look. Everybody else just was transfixed on the sight. The driver of the other car got out and staggered from his car. He had been drinking, but was basically okay. And I remember turning and seeing my dad standing almost next to us, several feet away, having just come out of the burger joint with a bag of food and a paper carton with drinks in his hand, looking out at the wreck, still trying to get past the "that's not my car" moment. It didn't seem to compute. And then the reading was a series of questions that run through your mind. Where are the kids? Is everyone all right? Did they get hurt? Is it worse than that? I'm going to go on if I lose another one. He didn't look over at us until my mom had called his name five times. "Chester." He distractedly turned his head in our direction, wondering who would know him by name. But she'd finally gotten his attention. "We're here. It's okay. We're here." And even then, he seemed confused and uncomprehending. My mom went up to him and gave him a reassuring hug. "We're all right. Something kept telling me to go to the tables. Go to the tables. I just couldn't stop thinking about it." My dad put the food down and did what had to be done that night. After the incident, my mom thought about it a lot. We could have been in that car, but we weren't. She was convinced that the nagging, relentless urge to go to the tables was not an accident, but rather an urgent message from her lost daughter, now guardian angel, who was watching over us that night. The timing of the message and the unending desire to get out of the car at that moment seemed too coincidental to be an accident, or just a lucky set of circumstances. And I believe she was right.
Yeah. No kidding. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, I've heard stories like that, that many people have shared signs. I've talked about it myself. You know, seeing my grandfather's soul leave his body. I told the story last month about when my beagle was lost, and I lost her after 15 and a half years, and I come home and within...
Well, talk about a powerful story. I got to throw this to you, Michael, and ask you what you think about this spiritual sense felt by David.
Well, it is very powerful, you know, to have that clarity
that it was a message and to know who that message was from. And, you know, for me as an outsider, it's very hard to know that, but I don't doubt at all the teller's clarity that that's what it was. And I think that's, you know, it's to each of us when we're in situations like that to be aware of what it means to us, because it may not mean the same thing to anybody else. It doesn't matter. It's what it means to you that really matters.
Well, I found in my life some of the most powerful experiences I've had defy explanation, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that they're not very, very real.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's extraordinarily foolish and ignorant to think that we understand everything there is to be understood. And mm-hmm. I think every generation has felt incorrectly that they finally understand everything.
Right.
You know, I recall reading about the head of the U.S. Patent Office in 1918 sending a letter to the president asking to close the patent office because everything that could possibly be invented had already been invented. Mm-hmm. 1918.
Yeah.
Amanda, what are your impressions of David's story?
Oh, it really filled my spirit. I got goosebumps, and I think, especially having lost both of my parents, I feel those moments when they're close to me, and I try and listen. And so I don't doubt for a moment that that's what that family experienced. I'm so happy you shared that story.
You know, I concur with both of your thoughts on it. I think we've all been in that situation, mm-hmm. particularly when you've lost someone who's inextricably a part of you.
Right.
You know, and I do believe in one way or another, in ways I won't understand for a long time, but the communication does continue at times. Well, Amanda, as you can tell from the sleeping dog in my lap and from our various shows, that we are all animal lovers on this show. So we know you can love another dog while maintaining the loving memories of the other. I often say, you know, my heart doesn't heal from the loss of an animal, but it does get bigger and allows me to love again. This is the core of your next story, so tell us that tale. And yes, that pun was intended.
Well, for the second story, I thought I would share a tale as old as time, one of first love, heartbreak, and the very terrible consequences that can come from a rushed rebound. Now, I was only 7 when I met Babe. She was the runt of a litter that came from my Grandma Patsy's rotund and revered Dachshund Red Dog. My parents had decided I could have my own pet, and having first pick of the litter, I really agonized over the choosing. What swayed me definitively towards Babe was my dad's explanation of the runt's worth. A runt comes into the world at a disadvantage, and in their perseverance for resources and survival, they just tend to develop the best personalities. Having 2 gargantuan older brothers, I guess I fancied myself the runt of my own family, and it made me keen to Babe. And as she grew, she proved to be a force of nature. She was scrappy. And what she lacked in size, she definitely carried in spirit. And I guess I realized she had a bit of a mean streak early on, but it amused me, and I realized I could harness it and use it against those whom I so chose, usually my cousin Gina, in a game I coined Shark Out of Water, wherein her feet became targets for Babe. And Babe was happy to be my accomplice, my partner in crime for years, but looking back, I think early on she realized she was surpassing me. I mean, when I turned 9, she was already 5 dog years older than me. And she developed a limited patience for being casted and costumed in my various theatrical productions. And I guess things really shifted when she became pregnant with her own litter of puppies. I fretted about it, and I wondered if she would lose interest in me once they got here. But while initially upsetting, very upsetting, I was quite proud to discover one night that she had given birth to the puppies where she was most comfortable, under my covers, at my feet as I slept. There was no doubting Babe's love for me, and our breakup was nothing I could have foreseen, but the end came quick. It began when my parents gifted me 3 Easter chicks, 1 green, 1 pink, 1 blue. I was to care for the chicks until they were ready for the chicken coop. My parents raised chickens at the time, and Babe let it be known that their presence was a personal affront to her. She would stand growling at their cage until I was forced to let her out of my room. And one evening, coming back from a movie with my parents, I found the chicks had escaped. The cage door swung ominously open, and I searched up and down for them, and Babe followed, you know, right behind me. And it was just when I had given up and my parents talked me into bed, I discovered the horror of what had happened. Placed upon my pillow was a rainbow of carnage. The chicks laid neatly in a row. Their necks had been pierced, and they had passed. Babe, the culprit, sat wagging her tail wildly, so pleased that I had found my gift. And things went cold for us after the incident. I couldn't reconcile or forgive Babe's homicidal nature, and she seemed aggravated at my ingratitude for her gift. So when my grandmother Opal moved in with us, Babe took no time cozying up to her, and over time it became obvious she had left me. I was more than bitter about it. So when I learned that my parents, after a passing of one of their friends, had been asked if they would take ownership of a 14-year-old blue macaw, I was desperate to get them on board. I couldn't imagine any better pet to fill the void that Babe had left in my heart. And I knew my dad was dead set against it, but I also knew if I could get to my mom at just the right moment and convey my level of heartache over my Judas dog murdering my chicks and leaving me for grandma, that parrot was mine. And it totally worked. But not without me taking full responsibility and ownership of Blue, which meant she would be housed in my room and I would learn the ins and outs of exotic bird care. I would also take a vow of silence should all of this blow up in my face. In preparing for Blue's arrival, we learned the following. She was a bit traumatized over the passing of her owner. She was an independent and spirited creature who had taken to using an actual toilet when the mood struck her, a parlor trick that was far messier than anyone anticipated. And she had spent a lot of time in the company of a group of rowdy teenagers, which had resulted in the development of a colorful vocabulary and propensity for insult. All red flags. But I was happy she was coming, and the moment I met her, I was genuinely startled by how large she was and how prehistoric she looked. And when I reached out my arm to her, confident she would recognize me as her soulmate and new owner, she reared back her wings and let out a war cry squawk indicating I was under attack. And my only defense reflex was to hit the ground in a stop, drop, and roll maneuver I had learned at school. And things did not get easier, and they did not get better. Blue took an active disliking to me, which she liked to let be known at any opportunity. When I would sing or read to her, she would respond with, and I'll edit this for radio, "Shut the F up!" And caring for her was quite a task because she wouldn't let me come within 3 feet without me stop, drop, and rolling. So, yeah, it was a hard time for me. And at night, she would click across the room. She would also scream out the name Mary, which turned my blood cold, and I would keep awake, hidden under my covers. And I was sure she was plotting something just most evil. I figured it was only a matter of time before my parents found me pecked clean. And, you know, I missed Babe, and I was sad that things had gone bad between us and I had let birds come between us. I realized I had gone from a complicated relationship to an abusive one. And the silver lining was my dad taking a liking to Blue and Blue surprisingly taking a liking to him, and they got in the habit of going on long walks on the hill country property where we lived. It was on one such walk that Blue took flight. she was able to do this. This was an ability she resurrected in her resilience to keep me from clipping her wings. So she flew off, and we tried desperately to get her back. Me not so much, but my parents, they really did. And we tried, but she was gone, and I was relieved. Blue had taught me a lot of things in our time together, but mostly it was there are worse things than being alone. And I was so happy I was.
That is a wonderful story. What's that saying? You know, if you love something, let it go. I guess this is if something annoys you, let it go.
Let it go.
Let it go. Well, I don't know if this is an easy question to answer, but what do you want to tell us about the relationship between loss and love?
Well, as I've grown older, I've realized that you don't only become grateful for all the good things. You also become deeply appreciative for loss, for your heartbreaks, because you realize they're the things that give you the resilience and the strength that you have now.
Well said. Very well said. Shifting just a bit to storytelling and writing, Amanda, I know you construct your stories by putting a writing utensil to paper. What differences do you feel between writing a story and telling it?
Well, I love starting with pen to paper because you can really work through your story intimately that way, and your memory surfaces in a way. It just, for me, it's a little bit different telling a story off the cuff. You're really able to dive deeper into memory.
Yeah. What about you, Michael?
Well, I mean, it's two fundamentally different things. I mean, of course, it's the same language, but to me, the story is a performance. The story without someone to hear it is just, mm-hmm. you know, it's not really real. It's moving up to something, whereas writing can be something that is its own reward. I mean, hopefully someday somebody will read it, or maybe not. Maybe it's private. But the story, you know, for me, writing is about clarifying what I want to say, mm-hmm. and how I want to do it. It's always about the other.
Well, you know, and I also find I've never told a story twice exactly the same way, because when I get before that audience, and you know, almost every storyteller I've talked to understands what I'm talking about, but it's still hard to explain. You're standing on stage alone, looking at the audience, and you're getting something back from them that you can't put a finger on, mm-hmm. but it controls. Like if I need a laugh here, if I need something serious here, if I want to confuse them for a few seconds, and it's different with every audience. And I've never been able to explain exactly what that feeling is that I'm getting from the audience, but every storyteller seems to know exactly what I'm talking
about.
Yeah,
there's an energy exchange.
There is.
You know, and you may be the one verbally speaking, but you're picking up something from the audience.
And I absolutely love that feeling. And I'll just mention this very briefly. You know, my last few years of speaking and storytelling have opened up a lot of doors for me. And quite unexpectedly, a couple of weeks ago, I was invited to give a talk in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting standing before a ballroom full of people that didn't speak my language and having a translator, you know, translate my words, and then having to stand there and wait. But you know what? That magic was still there. That relationship with the audience was mm-hmm. still there, and they were still listening to me. The translator was just kind of, you know, it's very easy mm-hmm. to tune out. But I realized while I was telling the story that even despite most of them not sharing my language, they were still listening to the storyteller. And that was a really nice exchange. And, you know, in the coming weeks, I'm sure I'll tell you more about my South Korean adventure, but it was fantastic, and I'm still recovering, and I'm thankful to have such, you know, two outstanding guests helping me carry the load this evening, because I think I'll catch up on my sleep in about a month. It was 16 hours in the air each way in about 5 days. Now, Michael, how about your perceptions? Oh, I'm sorry, between writing and telling a story. We discussed that. Hank, what about you? Are you out there?
I am, Greg. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I want our listeners to pay attention to is that you guys are talking about stages, but we're talking about stories to our family and our friends. sometimes we're sitting there just telling a story to a few people. Now, what Michael says is right. It is a performance of sort. But one of the things that I like doing is that when I jot down notes or when I write a story, I'm trying to relive it. But, you know, most people are not going to be standing on a stage telling a story. But most of us are going to be telling a story in front of a few people, at parties, at gatherings, to our families, our friends, our children. And we want to take them on a journey. And sometimes jotting down notes gives us an opportunity to relive it in our own mind so we can take our listener on that journey and then return them safely to the present.
What are you, a communications professor or something? That was very impressive.
Goddamn right.
Amanda, as a designer for Ethan Allen, I'm wondering if you see a different the connection. Is there a connection between crafting a story and designing a home? Are there similarities?
Oh, sure. I think most important, it's getting the story from those that, you know, invite me into their home. And the home is, you know, aesthetically, the visual story you want to tell about yourself and your family. So I love collaborating with people on that, helping them.
I can imagine. It must be really interesting to meet people and then go inside their homes and...
Oh, yeah. It feeds something really creepy in me. I just love going into other people's houses. I have since I was a kid. So now I get to do it professionally, and I relish it.
Well, in another life, I had sort of a similar experience when I worked in family law. You know, I would meet people. They'd sit down in my office, and then basically I'd say, okay, tell me about the most intimate details of your life that you didn't think you would ever tell anybody. And would you like a cup of coffee before you start? You know, and it is a very interesting voyeuristic experience, I think, in both.
Yeah, helping them tell their story, obviously, as a counselor, I do that too.
I was just going to say, Michael, you probably are even more so than both of us.
Mm-hmm. But I really liked what you said, Amanda, about, you know, you are trying to help them say... You're trying to help them represent something with their style. So it isn't just have it look pretty. It's about representing their values. It is about telling their story in a way.
Absolutely.
You know, one feature that we've added to the program since we've become an hour as opposed to a half hour is we often have tips for the teller, which I hope encourages everyone listening to find the storyteller within them and find those tips that help them, because everybody is a storyteller. We say it all the time. And whether it's sitting around with your family, your friends, your coworkers, or a professional situation, you are a storyteller. And the more comfortable you get with it, the more you're going to enjoy it. But we thought this time that we would take tips from the tellers. So first, Amanda, we will start with you. What is one storytelling tip, just one, that you would like to give our listeners?
I would maybe say don't discount any story that comes up. If something surfaces and it amuses you, work on it. There's more there.
Very true. Mm-hmm. Very true. Michael?
In a similar way, I think just scanning your memory to find an image, to find something, if it's still sticking around with you 10 or 20 years later, there's a value to it. There's a reason why it's stuck in your memory. So it's probably worth exploring and cultivating as something somebody else would like to hear.
Very true. And while the overall story may be what sticks with you and you don't remember the details, you'll find if you go back to that time and place, the details will come flooding back. And there have been times.
It's a feeling. It's an image that you have. And you know, cultivating that memory allows you to express that.
Absolutely. And there have been times when I felt like I had to write so fast because, you know, that memory hadn't been there in 20 years and I was afraid it was going to leave me if I didn't get it written down really, really quickly. And sometimes those are the details that audiences most enjoy, whether it's an audience of three or an audience of 300. Hank, would you join in here?
Sure. What would you like me to join in to do?
Well, I have a long list.
I'm sitting here thinking that I was on break. I'm sorry. I was having a...
You don't get any breaks.
I know.
I've seen your contract.
I know.
No, but we'd like a tip from the tellers.
A tip from the teller.
Yes,
oh,
sir.
Oh, my gosh. I probably shouldn't have said anything that was even remotely insightful a few minutes ago, or else you wouldn't be calling on me. Okay. you know, I think it's really important to know that everybody is a natural storyteller, and you guys said that very articulately, and you're right, very eloquently, because we are all natural storytellers. We all have to put things together in some kind of coherent form so that they resonate with people who would know about it unless we shared it. The idea of knowing that we are incredibly unique, that we really are one of a kind, is one of the most important prerequisites for telling a story. You can't fail. You matter. You are worthwhile. And I know that's more of an attitude, Greg, but you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
The idea of constructing a story, frankly, constructing a story and sequencing a story isn't really the most important thing, because it's kind of an easy thing. The really important thing is to think about the episodes in your life, having a sense of focus, understanding that your wedding day isn't the story. It's the moment you looked at the wedding cake, realizing that the names on them weren't yours. You know, that's the story. That's the episode. And I think that as long as we have a sense of focus, a sense of humor, and a sense of who we are, there will always be a story in our heart.
Wow, that was beautiful off the cuff, Hank.
Thank you very much. It's the medications. You know, I took a lot of them tonight, and clearly they're doing something pretty wonderful.
And if you Googled that,
and who are you people?
If you Googled that, you were fast.
Where are we, by the way? Who are you people? Okay. Thank you.
You know, another thing that I'd like to remind people is your story is your story. Even if you went through it, well, you know, like Michael's story of his daughters on the beach, I guarantee you there's not one story from that. There's three, mm-hmm. you know, and that each person involved is going to have their own story. So don't ever think, oh, you know, no one's going to be interested. Yeah, you know, people really are interested in your stories. And I'd say 90% of the time, even when I'm just sitting around and hear someone's story, I'm almost always glad they shared it with me. I really am. Now, we've got a few questions we like to ask our tellers, standard, and I'm curious about your family, Amanda, because you said you come from a long line of storytellers. Who in your home would you say was the predominant storyteller?
Well, I think they'd fight over it. I would say my dad. You know, when he was talking, people listen. My mom was actually not a great storyteller. She was profoundly bad. She would chase rabbits, just ADD to the max. But my dad, he loved to share. Both of my grandmothers were wonderful storytellers, too. So, but I would say my dad was my inspiration for storytelling.
It's such a wonderful way to get to know family, particularly when they're considerably older. You know, it's nice to get lost in their stories. Although I do have one friend who one time was... He was older, and he was telling a story with a group of friends, and another friend at the table, and I won't name him, said, "Hey, that's not your story. It's mine." And my friend said, "Well, I've heard it for so many years. I just thought it was mine." Mm-hmm. And he says, "Besides, I tell it better than you do anyway." How about you, Michael? Who is the storyteller in your family?
Well, big family, so a lot of folks, but the real clear model was my grandfather, Mr. Ralph. He told stories. He told Bell Witch stories. He told family history stories. He had us grandkids all spellbound when he would tell a story.
Well, I don't know if you experienced this with your grandfather, but I have certain friends who have stories that I love so much. They'll say to me, "Now, have I ever told you this story?" I'm like, "No, because I love hearing it again."
Yeah.
You know, and some stories I may have heard 10 times, but the answer is always no. I haven't heard it. Can you tell me? And about halfway through, they'll play, "I'm sure I've told you this before," because I can kind of predict where it's
going.
Yeah,
and family lore, if he had told us once, you know, it might get lost. But there's things that are part of our family history that are not written down. They're passed on orally, and he'd told the story 50 times. And so each grandkid may have a quite different memory of it, but we have the heart of it. So
and I forget,
retelling.
How many siblings do you have?
14.
14?
Wow.
13 siblings. I'm the 14th.
Wow, so most stories that happen in your family, there's probably at least 14 versions of
well,
it.
Well, not everybody was always around for everything. But yes, there are many different ways of viewing the story.
That would kind of actually be a cool thing sometime, to have different people tell their story of the same event.
Mm-hmm. I think I do it better than all the rest.
Yeah. Of them, Well, you're the one on the radio, I got to give you credit for that. What about you, Amanda? Were there stories, you know, that you cling on to?
Oh, absolutely. Stories that I would make my grandmothers tell over and over again. One was why my grandma believed in reincarnation. I love that story. Any ghost story. And the very best story I've ever heard told live was my brother telling a story. And he made me swear I would not say anything about it on the radio. So I'll leave it at that. But, Josh,
will you tell me after the show?
Sure.
All right. You know, it's funny, for a storyteller, I never really thought about it until you said that, but after those we love are gone, it really is the stories that remain, mm-hmm. you know, and that's how we keep them alive, their mm-hmm. memories, but also their stories, you know. I can tell stories from my grandparents that happened in the 1920s, you know, and I was mm-hmm. a few decades away from being here, but I can picture exactly right. how they went down because, mm-hmm. you know, I just loved relishing every minute of the story. You know, including my teenage grandmother mourning for Rudolph Valentino. You
wow.
know,
yeah.
I wasn't there, but I can just picture it absolutely perfectly. When did you realize you were a storyteller, Michael, or did you always know?
I don't know. I'm still learning it. It just comes out sometimes.
I feel like every time I tell a story, I become that much more of a storyteller. I learn something every single time. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever walked off the stage or walked out of the studio thinking, that was just like the other time. I always feel mm-hmm. better. Well, Amanda Dayton and Michael Winters, I want to thank you for your meaningful journeys, your signature styles, and your insights tonight. We had a little time to get a little more insightful than normal. And next week, Mary Edgerton will be our host right here on So What's Your Story? And don't you dare move, because the Vinyl Avenger and Wild Bill are up next with cool classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. I'm Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
KPFT Houston thanks our community partners, Artist Boat, a nonprofit organization providing inspiration and education through unique coastal experiences, including kayak adventures on the waters around Galveston Island and guided walking tours. Visit artistboat.org for more information. And AIDS Foundation Houston, offering free HIV testing every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. Visit AIDSHelp.org for more information. This is KPFT Houston.
Thank you.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Hello, it's the Vinyl Show.